The topic of love is, in a way, very easy to approach because it is an emotion that we are all, without doubt, without exception, acquainted with, felt it, feeling it now, and for the rest of our life, we would go through the experience of love. So, speaking about love, the topic itself is very approachable in one sense. Yet, when we examine what is love, we will find that there are many kinds of love. In our own life, we see that I love my car. That is one kind of love. I love to eat certain kinds of food, a taste for a kind of food. That's another. Then I love my parents and my wife, my family. That's something else. And my parents love me. My family loves me. And I love my job. I like to work in a certain kind of environment. That's another kind. Then there is love for knowledge, wisdom, or love for arts, mathematics. These are all separate category. So in our own life, we find that there is a variety of things and variety of subjects that we love. There are other examples that we find in the ancient scriptures. Take Ramayana. The love that Rama had for Sita and the love that Ravana had for Sita are of different, not in degree, but in kind. The love that Rama had for his father and the honor of his father, and the love that Kaikeyi had for her son's welfare is again another kind. And there is love of Lakshman for Ram. There is love of Hanuman for Ram. There is love of Ram for his kingdom, which puts his kingdom and the welfare of his society more than his own welfare and the welfare of his family. That is of another kind. So, in one scripture, we find innumerable kinds of love of various. Some differing in degree, some differing in kind. Similarly, in Mahabharata, the love of Dhritarashtra for his son blinded him, whereas the love of Arjuna for his guru, Krishna, opened up cosmic vision for him. One love resulted in blindness and chaos and war, another love resulted in opening up of spiritual vision, cosmic vision, and liberation. The love that our Yudhishthira had for dharma, righteousness, the love which he had for righteousness above everything else, is of a uniquely different kind. So there are certainly different kinds of love. Each of them produce different kinds of result. They arise from different parts of our nature. Man is composed of various kinds of, various entities, various cosmic forces, and The love that arises from each of his aspect of nature differs from the love that arises from a different aspect of his nature. In the Platonic dialogue, the Symposium, the most poetic and no wonder that it speaks of, its main theme is that of love. There, Plato gives the various degrees of love, the various definitions of love, and through the various characters in the dialogue, he brings across the various prevalent views about love, some of which are quite relevant even for today. And Platonic, that particular dialogue itself is filled with many characters, very colorful. There is a legal expert, there is a physician, there is a comic playwright, there is a tragic poet. Each of them give their version of what is love. And finally comes the brilliant synthesis of all these various kinds of loves, synthesized by the brilliant mind of Socrates, who says that, you know, man, when he is ignorant, he begins with the love of beautiful bodies. Any body which is beautiful, he is attracted to it. But through education, he graduates into love of beautiful minds as the second step. So he has transcended the love of the physical body and looks at love of the beautiful minds. And third step is when he is attracted and starts loving knowledge. And finally, as the ultimate goal, he reaches that state which is to witness beauty in itself rather than any of its representations. So this fourth stage of love, he says, is the supreme, the highest. So there is a gradual, more and more expansive, more and more cosmopolitan, liberating idea of love that Socrates presents in, Plato presents in the Socratic dialogue. Now, looking at all these various kinds of love, we can at least categorize the kinds of love into three buckets. There is the love of the physical kind, or the love which is based on the feeling, what is it that I can get out of this, irrespective of the consequences, irrespective of what happens to others. This in the Greek terminology was called as eros. Eros, that is, it is self-centered feeling which says, what is it that I can get? And secondly, slightly better form of love, which is philia, which means there is a pragmatic relationship of give and take. There is a certain mutuality, a love that is based on mutuality. That is, I give something, I also receive back something, so there is mutual. Better than the previous one. The final, the third category that we can recognize in various of these examples is what is not called by this name in the Platonic dialogue, but in the subsequent commentators and writers speak of it, it's called as agape, which means that kind of love which strains to give. It is not concerned about itself or its welfare, but effort is to give, which is unconditioned love. So in one of the ULT pamphlets, on the cover page, there's a nice quotation which is given, not sure who is the author, But it says, he who loves lives. He who loves himself lives in hell. He who loves another lives on earth. He who loves all others lives in heaven. So, that's what the quote says. So, living is loving. Loving is living. Without that, there is no, we cannot even understand what life is. Very close to the idea of love of the third kind, the higher kind, agape, is the idea of forgiveness. You know, when would we forgive? When would be in a position to forgive another? When we feel we have been hurt by the other, whether it has been done through, you know, whether we rightfully deserve that or not, we feel we are hurt. And we have the power to either avenge ourselves, take revenge, or create more trouble for the one who caused us trouble, or we decide to forgive. Now, there are various reasons why we would now want to forgive and not continue with hate. But let us consider a very noble example. Because without considering the best of the example and keeping it as a kind of model for us, looking up to it like a prototype, which we can, to the extent possible in our lives, follow, imitate, and put into practice in our own life. Without doing this, if we keep a example which is of a mediocre kind, then we will ascend only to the mediocre level. So, a very good example, many are there across the world, in our own country also, but one of them that we will consider today, which speaks of forgiveness, which is an aspect of love of the higher kind, is that we find in the life of Ramana Maharshi. Many of you would already know this story. Nevertheless, it is worth repeating. There was a disciple, very devoted disciple of Ramana, called as Perumal Swami. And those were the days in late 1920s. When Skandashram was there and the current Ramanashram was still not set up. And Perumal became one of the most devoted disciple of Ramana. His love for Ramana was, you know, there are no other examples to compare it with. He would take every single pain to ensure that Ramana is not put to any kind of trouble. He was Ramana's attendant, his manager, and he would even manage the ashram's affairs. Such was his devotion to his teacher that one time when Ramana was stuck with dysentery, diarrhea, and Ramana could not crawl out of the house to visit the bathroom, Perumal would catch the excrement in his hand, go out, bury it, wash his hand, and come back and be ready to serve his teacher. So the devotion that Perumal had towards Ramana was unparalleled. But it so happened that after the Skandashram days were over and the ashram was set up at the foothills of Arunachala, and a managing committee was set up, and ashram control was not there anymore with Perumal, he turned more and more hostile towards Ramana as well as towards the whole ashram members. Such was his, rancor and animosity that he developed towards his own teacher and the ashram, that it was a complete diametric opposite of the earlier Perumal Swami. He would create a stamp in the name of Ramanashram, go to the post office, collect all the couriers, letters, and especially the money orders which has been sent by various people across the world to support the ashram, and he would steal the money. He was more and more disturbed that he was no more at the head of the affairs of the ashram. So he created a lot of problems for the ashram. And it's not one incident, two incident, 1 or 2 years. But for nearly 2 decades, he caused a lot of provocation to ashram members and caused a lot of trouble. He wrote a book full of lies, slander, and named it as The Reality About Ramana Maharshi or something like that in Tamil. And in the midst of all this provocation, it is the love that Ramana had towards Perumal and the forgiveness that was there, the patience and tolerance that Ramana had towards Perumal, which is the example that we need to consider. 2-3 things we can understand from this story. When Perumal wrote that book full of slander, lies about Ramana having an affair and all sorts of rubbish about Ramana, whose character was impeccable, all the ashram members were quite agitated. They wanted to go to the town and, fix Perumal, take care of him. And Ramana was quite, he said, that's not our dharma. Instead of taking care of him and feeling animosity towards him, he said, what we should do is, we should in fact sell the book at the entrance of our ashram so that those who are true disciples will anyway come and visit ashram, while those who are those who are coming here for some ulterior or some selfish purpose will read the book and turn away. So we should publish this book more, print more copies and sell it at the ashram gates. And in the book, Perumal had said, these are the incidents that I know about Ramana. There are many other incidents which I know, but I have not written here. And when Ramana read it, it seems he said, oh, he should have come to me. I know so many incidents about my life, which he doesn't know, which shows me in poor light. I could have told him, he could have added it to the book also. And this, mind you, Ramana is not telling this in a sarcastic way, but genuinely, without any hatred towards Perumal. And then Perumal went and lodged a court case to take possession of the whole ashram premises. None of it disturbed Ramana. Ramana's attitude towards Perumal was still one of patience and forgiveness. And the story has a very nice ending where after 20 years of constant provocation, irritations, Perumal's, there is a karmic backlash on him, a quick karmic backlash. He loses his reputation. He loses all his source of money. His family abandons him. He's struck with disease. Then he repents. He realizes the mistake he has made. after losing everything in life. So Perumal has finally, in during his last days, he comes to the ashram. He cannot even walk, he has to be carried in a cart. He comes and says to Bhagavan, "Bhagavan, I have made a great mistake. Forgive me, but don't forget me." Then Ramana says, "How can I ever forget you?" Now, if one of us were to say this, then it would mean that you have caused me so much trouble, how can I forget you? But what Ramana says is, you are myself. Can I ever forget myself? Impossible. Similarly, how can I forget you? It is in that spirit of oneness that Ramana says this. And then finally Perumal says, "Oh God, oh Bhagavan, I am going to hell, I am going to hell, I know it, I am going to hell." And Ramana quiet for a few minutes and then says, "Don't worry, I will be there also." So this kind of broad, broad, large-hearted examples are there for us to learn from. Now, we are all not Ramana Maharshis to have that kind of magnanimity at once. But potentially, we are all Ramanas. And whether we are Ramana Maharshi, certainly we are not at his stage. But one thing is for sure, we all have Perumal Swamis in our life. It is a given truth that we all have people in our life who traduces, trouble us, causes irritations, provocations, whose very sight, whose very thought, instantly puts our entire body into rage. It may be with the person, may be within the family, in our office, in various other relationships that we have in the life. So, irrespective of whether we are Ramana or not, we all have Perumal Swamis in life. Now, how do we deal with this? What the teacher says is, forgive such people, forget their offense, return good to when they do evil. But that's a very, very strange advice, isn't it? Very counterintuitive. To reciprocate is what we do. You give me good, I will give you good. You give me love, I will reciprocate it. But you hate me and you provide, you give me trouble, but still the teacher say you reciprocate it with love. It's very counterintuitive. What does Jesus say? He says, when the disciple asks, "Father, should I forgive the one who offends me, even if he does the offense 7 times? Jesus says, not just 7 times. Even if he does the offense 70 times 7, you should forgive him. Why would Jesus say that? And in the Platonic dialogue, Gorgias, Plato establishes that fundamental ethical principle in Plato's philosophy, that it is better to suffer injustice, it is better to suffer evil than to commit one. Very strange. The yoga aphorisms of Patanjali say that ahimsa is not just the duty of rishis and munis and saints and sages, but it is universal great duties incumbent on all beings, that you should not harm others irrespective of what the other person is doing to you. Why would they say that? One thing is to say that, all these teachers, whether it is Ramana or Shankara, Plato or any other philosopher of worth mentioning, that they are all insane, that they are all talking something meaningless. That is one way of looking at it. But that would be a very dangerous thing, and we would only expose our ignorance and foolishness when we say that. So the one idea that helps us understand why the teachers ask us to forgive others, which is a very deep form of love and concern, is based on the idea that there are different levels of reality. There are different levels of reality. We perceive reality in a certain sense, just as a child perceives and sees and experiences the world in a certain way. But the parent and the grandparents of the child have seen life and they see certain things and they guide the child and help the child to grow. Their experience of reality is something more, something deeper than the child's experience of the world. Similarly, when the sages say forgive, don't retaliate, return good for evil, they must be functioning from a different, deeper, higher level of reality. In fact, this idea that there are levels of reality and the majority of the world is not, have not yet developed the kind of inner vision to see reality as it is, things as they are. But most of us perceive things as they seem, the world of appearance, the world of separateness. This idea forms the very cornerstone of every single dialogue of Plato. Every dialogue of Plato either establishes on a firmer ground this basic idea of what he calls as the analogy of the divided line, or it is based on this idea and explores many other ideas while being rooted on this idea of levels of reality. So this is a very foundational idea which you find in all great scriptures. And this gives us a hint as to why the great teachers ask us to forgive, because they see a certain layer of reality, whereas we are not yet seeing it, though we have the potentiality to understand and reach the kind of vision that they have had. And it is also based on the fact that when the teachers say forgive and love everyone, irrespective of what the person, what the other person's feeling is towards you, it is also based on the fact that there are two ways in which you can bind yourself to others. The power of human mind, human thought is so much, so dynamic in its nature that somewhere the teacher says that, you know, if you are able to suppress a single thought, you can see on the inner plane that you have overcome a crowd of circumstances in your future life. A single thought produces a crowd of circumstances in your future life. So that thought manifests itself, produces itself, reproduces itself, and puts you in that situation, a self-made destiny. And then you have to experience the effects of those causes. Such is the power of the human mind. So that power of the human mind can be either used to bind ourselves more, or we can meaningfully use our minds, direct our minds along the right lines, and use it to liberate. Liberate others, liberate ourselves. So, two ways to bind ourselves to another person. One is love. You intensely love a person. Care for him or her. Serve him. Take care of their needs. Produce that deep sentiment in you. And that sentiment, especially if it's unselfish, is undying. That is, the body dies, but the power generated by that sentiment, that noble sentiment, that unselfish sentiment, carries across lives and brings you more and more with that person in various relations, and the person will be helpful to you, you will be more helpful to the person, and there is a glorious relationship of great friendship or any other kind of relationship but deeply based upon mutual love, feeling, cherishing. That is one way of binding ourselves to another person beyond death. The other way to bind yourself to anybody is hate. You intensely hate a person. Now, generally, what the understanding is, when you hate something, you go away from it. But in reality, that is not so. What the teachers say is, the more you hate something or someone, the closer and closer you are bound to that thing or that person. And just like, you know, we all have our mobile phones and it shows the battery status, right? How much percentage of battery is remaining. And given the kind of programs that you run on your mobile, you can clearly calculate if this is the amount of charge that I have, this is the time that it takes to discharge. Similarly, on the occult plane, the teachers say, if you see the power of hate, the power of dislike, it at least runs through three lives. In other words, if we generate a feeling of dislike and hate another person, at least for three lives you will be brought with that person again and again. Whether it is three subsequent lives or some other, you know, spread across many, that's not the question. But the energy that we have generated in hating the person binds us to that person, and he becomes inimical to you, you become inimical to him, and you don't know why this relationship is so strained. In our own lives, we find that we have so many good friends who are naturally good to us. We have not done anything especially good to them in this life that we can think of. But they are so kind to us. They are so helpful to us. They are so concerned about us. Similarly, you know, Emerson says it very beautifully in one of his essays on friendship. He says, when true friends come together, they bind themselves together and, you know, as easy and as natural as two chemical atoms which are sympathetic to one another bind together. Very intuitive statement. So we, you know, in our life we find these people who are very friendly to us. We can't explain why. We have a feeling of friendship towards them, of help and love and concern, and they reciprocate it also. And then there are Perumal Swamis in our life. Those who cause us so much trouble, irritation and provocation, and we don't even know why they are doing that. And unfortunately, even they don't understand why they do that. There is a certain inner reaction set in them which makes that animosity comes up, surge to the surface, express itself. They harm us, I harm them, and then there is a spiral, downward spiral that we set up in our life for the destruction of both of us. It is a downward spiral of retaliation, hate, rancor, revenge. And mind you, this is not only about individuals, it's about communities also. Do we not see that in our own country? Systematic and deliberate generation of hate of one community towards another. And this is not something new today, going on for generations. We find it across the world among various nations. Inexplicable hate, animosity, and communities generate this hate over generation after generation. Retaliation. One time, one community is at the upper hand. They take advantage of it and cause harm to others. Then the feeling of revenge is harbored by the other community or even the other nation. They retain it, and then over generations it builds on. They get the upper hand, and then they retaliate. This kind of spiral of hate results in more and more destruction, and nature brings these communities closer and closer. It's not that they hate and then they are set apart at the two sides of the hemisphere. They will be neighbors. We see this across the world. Very strange. This is because nature brings us back again and again to things that we love and things that we hate. And when we hate somebody, it brings them back to us again and again, so that there is an opportunity for us to overcome that hate, change that relationship, and produce feelings of love. For this, we have to understand that the relationships that we have in our life are not forged just today or just in this life. The sentiments and the what are called as sympathies and antipathies are very magnetic in nature, and we carry it from life to life, and at the right circumstances, this kind of relationship explodes and produces the circumstances where me and the other person are brought closer and closer, and we have to work out the differences, because nature does not see any difference between me and him. In the eyes of nature, in the eyes of truth, we are like two drops in the same ocean, and trying to separate oneself from one another is foolish, is ignorant. Therefore, nature brings us back closer and closer, so that the higher purpose of our nature, higher evolution of our nature, can be accomplished by resolving these feelings of animosity, resolving these feelings of hate, and transforming it to something better, and transform the person as a friend, convert the person from an enemy to a friend. It is by this means that we will be able to serve our country. We don't need to go to the border and enroll ourselves in the army or defense forces to serve our country. As somewhere one of the teachers says, you know, doing all the duties of our life in the station that we are in, we make the world our debtor. So by examining our own nature and removing the traces and the weeds of hate that we have towards other people, other communities, other nations, other caste, creed, whatever may be the difference, distinctions, by understanding the laws of life and overcoming these, we make the whole country a better place, because the karma of the nation is formed by karma of each community, and each community's karma is formed by each individual's karma, each family's karma. So the act that we do, how we respond to others, is all deeply impactful of the destiny of our very country. So to be truly patriotic, one has to take up self-regeneration, acquire knowledge, the true philosophy, and regenerate oneself. And then there is also the hate that we feel about circumstances of life, which expresses in various ways. Complaint about life and a sort of dissatisfaction about the circumstances of life, and a deep wish that, oh, wish things were better, wish things were different. This kind of dissatisfaction. This is not dislike of person, but dislike of circumstance. And this doesn't need any examples, just like the previous section also did not need any examples. Because we all feel that, and we all know people who are especially, you know, have a complaining and critical attitude towards life circumstances. And here you have to read an article which was published in the Theosophical Movement magazine, which reviewed the book by Somerset Maugham. The book name is Of Human Bondage. There, the protagonist, one Philip Carey, he is in search of happiness, just like we all are. And the circumstances of his life is very trying. He goes through many experiences, love, betrayal, friendship, taken for a ride, and sacrifice, friendship, so many experiences. And somewhere in his life's journey, he comes across a bohemian, a talker, a poet, a drunk by name Cronshaw, who gives him a piece of Persian rug and says, "This contains the deepest secret of life. Hold on to this." He doesn't understand, the protagonist doesn't understand what it means, but in the end of his life, after so many different kinds of experiences, the protagonist realizes that, you know, just like the weaver weaved the carpet with different colored strands, different threads of different colors, the single thread taken without context of the rug doesn't make any sense. But when it is put in its right place, each of those threads have added to the grand design, the beauty, aesthetics of the rug, made it more beautiful. Then he realizes that all the circumstances of life are inherently meaningful. You cannot strive to find meaning by changing your circumstances of life, but by accepting for what they are and then understanding the meaning of it through, he doesn't say true philosophy, but he can infer it from it through the true philosophy of life. So this is what even the Stoics say. We will consider that and a couple of small things, and then we will close in 2 minutes or so. The Stoics say the same thing. They say, it was a Latin phrase made more popular these days, but mentioned by ancient Stoics, Epictetus, Marcus Aurelius, and so on, who say that love your fate, amor fati, love your fate, which means that the circumstances in which we are in is not accidental. Neither are they to be fought against, opposed, complained, and criticized. We are in that circumstances firstly because we have generated the causes which have put us there. And secondly, none of those circumstances, events of life, are there to punish us, to trouble us. But they are presented to us as opportunities. Opportunities to learn the lessons of life. Opportunities to correct the mistakes of the past. Opportunity to create a better future. So this attitude comes when we understand the broad vision that we get through the idea that we are all pilgrims, we are all souls who are passing through these various experiences, body after body. And in each life, our life circumstances are the result of the past, and most importantly, today, when we are facing the effects of the past, we have the power to change our future. We are not just passive recipients of the past, but active creators of the future. And how do we actively create a better future? Through our attitude of life. When we hold the right attitude towards life, which does not complain, which does not quarrel with life, but try to understand intelligently the meaning of these circumstances, try to understand the puzzle that is thrown to us through our enemies, the riddle that we have to unravel, and generate the right kind of feelings of compassion, love, forgiveness, patience, tolerance, develop these virtues, then life becomes deeply meaningful, like the Persian rug example. So they say that what is the obstacle in your way becomes the way. What you call as an obstacle is actually the way itself. You are seeing it as an obstacle, but what is the obstacle is the way. What is in the way becomes the way. What you think is stopping your progress is the very means through which higher progress can be attained. So the true philosophy of life should give us this kind of insight into the deep purpose of life, inherent meaningfulness of our events, the people around us, and the deep unity that underlies all beings. All these laws of karma, reincarnation, are all based upon the basic unity of man. That is, each one of us is not separate from others. And the true philosophy of life is based on this, and it explains this in innumerable ways. So we'll stop here and take up any points or questions or share your experiences.